Now, as we come to the end of David's reign, we notice that David's starting to do something. As far as Bible students, as we are Bible students, we should be looking, and this is interesting, and the study makes it a little bit more challenging at times, but we have the David's reign recorded in two different places. We have it recorded in Samuel and Kings. We have it recorded in Chronicles as well. So you have predominantly a lot of David's reign in 1st and 2nd Samuel. We have it in 1st Chronicles. We'll see that carry over into Solomon as well in 1st Kings. And we'll see it in Chronicles as well. And that's where we're going to start our study tonight, is in 1st Chronicles. You get some information in 1st Chronicles that we don't get in 1st Kings, but it kind of helps us as we discuss the end of David's reign. So in 1 Chronicles 22, we're looking at these first five verses. I ask the question, what did David start to do in verses 2 through 5?
Preparing for building the temple.
How do you do that?
Iron.
And so it talks about that he gave orders to gather foreigners in the land of Israel and to set stone cutters to hew out stones to build the house of God. It talks about how he gathered large quantities of iron for the nails in the doors of the gates, for the clamps, and for bronze, and more bronze than he could be weighed. He got timbers of cedar logs, so he's preparing to build the temple. Now, why doesn't David being the anointed one, the man after God's own heart, why doesn't David just go ahead and build the temple? God doesn't want him to. God told him no. He's a man of bloodshed. But David, being the man that he is, well, he can't build the temple, but he can definitely prepare for it. And so he has. And we're going to see that David has been preparing for that, for Solomon to be able to take the reins and to build the temple. We're going to touch on this for the next few classes, but the more I study on it, depending on how tech savvy I decide to be, I may try to, when we get to the actual building of the temple, discuss, not only the size and show some pictures, but it's not today's time. I work with heavy equipment all the time, and sometimes you're kind of amazed at how large things are built and then how you can manhandle certain things. It's different when you are working on a vehicle and the tires, this big on a car, kind of that big on a truck, versus the tires we work on are anywhere from about this high on a small side to that tall on a big side. Everything's built larger, and it's built for that reason. You're driving down 1960, you see the cranes right in the middle of the road. They're pouring concrete and they're setting beams and they're all doing it right there. All right, we're going to discuss, and over the next few classes, how this temple, how the materials were gathered, and how it was built. All by hands. I mean, you think about this. They had maybe very simple mechanical tools as far as that goes. Those simple tools, they're going to be very rudimentary in this. And then how they are able to erect such a massive structure, and the way in which they go about it too. Just the massive workload that's put into it, how they gather their resources. It's really amazing to me. I mention that because you think about that, going to cut stone. How do you go and cut stone? How do you do it now? You may not even know how you do it now. Anybody? Good question, right? I don't know. I'm assuming some type of machinery will go in there, it'll dig it, it'll cut it, or do something for you. How do you do it back then? And then you're thinking about how they're building something like 40 by 60 cubits, and they're building it in 2 and 3, not stories, but how are you doing that? It's amazing to think that they're going to hew this stone, they're going to cut it, they're going to have to transport it and all that. So be thinking about, as we talk about this, and we're going to be talking about what a magnificent temple this was going to be. This is going to be the house of God. And so as we go over these next few classes, we're going to be talking about what was put into this, and to think about what the house of God was, the tabernacle where he resided, until this temple. Was it a true representation of who God was, meaning he was worthy of this? So we'll talk about that as we get into class two. So you see that David's preparing for building the temple. So moving down into 6 through 19, what does David recount to Solomon in verses 7 through 10?
Temple because he was a man born in his shed blood.
All right. That's true. Where could we look back and kind of see this talked about? Okay, give me a scripture.
Are you talking about
2
Samuel
7? Yes, ma'am, that's what I'm talking about. 2 Samuel 7. Y'all don't know what, y'all can't read my mind. Y'all should be able to at this point, but y'all should be able to read my mind. But you think about this. We're looking back at 2 Samuel 7. This is David talking to Solomon about this idea here. You know, David said to Solomon, "My son, I intend to build a house in the name of my Lord God. But the word of the Lord came to me saying, 'You have shed much blood and have waged great war,'" which we didn't know then. That wasn't a part of that in 2 Samuel 7, but we know that that's the reason here. "You shall not build a house to my name because you have shed so much blood on the earth before me. Behold, a son will be born to you. He shall be a man of rest, and I will give him rest from all his enemies on every side. For his name shall be Solomon, and I will give peace and quiet to Israel in his days. And he shall build a house for my name, and he shall be my son, and I will be his father, and I will establish the throne of his kingdom over Israel forever." I will establish the throne of his kingdom over Israel forever. And so he's telling them about this covenant that God made with them. Hang on to that verse for a second. We're going to come back to it in a minute. All right. In this context, what and how had David prepared for the temple? He did. So he gathered a lot of the materials, and I specifically 100,000 talents of gold, 1,000,000 talents of silver, bronze, iron, beyond weight, great quantities of timber, stone. We talked about that a second ago, but I wanted to take a moment to try to see if we can fathom or understand exactly how much 100,000 talents of gold is, or how much 1,000,000 talents of silver is. Because you look at it and that looks like a large amount, but how far will that go? Do we understand what a talent is? So my question to you, and I had no idea, so if y'all don't know, that's fine. It was interesting in my study. Does anybody know what a talent is? It was considered currency, but more importantly, it was considered a unit of measure. So there was one gold talent as a currency, but it's meant as a unit of measure too. And so you had different types of currency. But it was a dual purpose. So you had a gold talent that could be used to pay things. It was a form of currency. Smaller versions of the currency were like a drachmas or denarii. Then you worked up to maybe silver, and then you worked up to the idea of a gold talent or a silver talent. Now, how much does a silver or gold talent weigh? Anybody know? There's varying and conflicting reports on this. So I've looked at several different things, but in a general sense, it weighed about 75 pounds. There are some that say it weighed more than that, closer to 100 pounds. But when you talk about one gold talent, you're talking about 75 pounds of gold, which is crazy to me, but that's what it was. And so 75 pounds of gold. All right. Now think about that. Now they had one talent weighing 75 pounds of gold. There's 100,000 of those talents, so that's 7.5 million pounds of gold sitting right there. That's a lot of gold. How much is that worth? Anybody have an idea what gold's going for these days? $1,800 an ounce. Todd must be watching it. He's pretty much dead on. I checked it yesterday, $1,869 an ounce. 16 ounces to a pound, 7.5 million pounds. In our time, how much do you think that equates to?
A couple million.
Yeah, give her. That's what you find on the couch cushion when you talk about this. $224 billion, the way we value it. So if you had 7.5 million pounds of gold, it's $224 billion. That was in our currency, our time, that's what you would have donated or have been amassed to build the temple. Now, we're talking about this is for God. This is what they've collected. You know, they're finding the most fine things to exemplify who God is. Now, he doesn't need the finest things on earth, but you're doing this for God. I built me a house, but you know, I need to exalt God and build him a house. And so we're going to find the finest things. And so, hey, what's better than $224 billion worth of gold? Silver. 1 million pounds of silver. Or a million talents of silver. So that puts us at, what is that? I have it written here somewhere. A lot of silver. 75 million pounds of silver. If you look at current prices of silver, that means 1 talent of silver is about $30,000. If you've got 1 million talents of silver, you're talking about $30 billion. This is what they have amassed. People have donated after battle. This is what they're using to build the temple. Just think about that for a second in our time and place. That's a lot. Now, how do you value that? And this is what was collected in battle. This is what was given. How do you value that then, though? I mean, gold could have been not worth as much then, or it could have been worth more then. So there was, as I was doing my studying, there was discussion about how would you value that in their time. I can't tell you gold was worth more or less but than what it is now. It was valued highly then. A lot of people said gold was worth about 20 times what silver was. Not that that really matters. But in Jesus' time, it would take 6,000 drachmas or one to make 1 gold talent. So 6,000 drachmas or 6,000 denarii to make 1 gold talent. Average wage in that time would be 1 drachma or 1 denarii, depending on what you called it, per day of work. All right, think about that. So you take 6,000 days to earn 1 gold talent. So it would take, let's see here, I think it was 60 million days of work to equal the 100,000 talents of gold. So that's a lot of work. So it was very valuable to them too. But this has been what has been collected as spoils of war, what had been donated for the temple. Just to say that they gave everything. They wanted it to be a representation of who God was. He should be exalted. He is the Most High. We're going to give everything. And this is what David had amassed over all this time to build this temple to God. David couldn't build it, but David wanted the finest things for God. And so he made sure that he provided for it so Solomon could build it. That was interesting to me. I know that's a little bit of an aside, but questions, comments on that? You're going to have to trust my math and my research, I know.
Well, on the bronze and iron, it said it was beyond weight.
It was beyond weight.
So then,
a lot. We don't think about that, too. You think about how we mine or refine that stuff now and how they gathered it then. And what form it was in and everything. We'll get to that when we talk about building the temple too. But yeah, beyond weight and how you're gonna form it into what you need to build the temple. How did you weigh that much? You know, talents would be easier because they're probably some type of specific unit, square or whatever that they could weigh it. But interesting. All right, moving on. Who else was commanded to help? So in this context, who else is commanded to help Solomon? So Solomon's tasked with doing this, but who else is commanded to help? Verse 17, David also commanded all the leaders of Israel to help his son Solomon. So if they were tasked to help Solomon, we're going to try to draw a conclusion here based on information. If they were told to help Solomon build the temple, then might they have known that Solomon was tasked with building the temple and he was the one that was fulfilling the prophecy and was to become the king? Am I making too far of an assumption? I wouldn't think so. There was a prophecy that was had, a covenant made with David. And you see that here, that these leaders are tasked to help Solomon. This is what he's told them. I wouldn't think it's far-fetched to understand that Solomon was to be the one to take the throne next. It's interesting as I was studying this, and I don't know about for you, but it's interesting where you try to fit in these chapters of 1 Chronicles 20, 22 to 29, where they fit in compared to Kings. Because this, to me, is important when we get to 1 Kings 1, which is where we're going to next. So, let's look over at 1 Kings 1. So, towards the end of David's life, he's prepared for the temple. We see that Solomon is charged with it and Israel is supposed to help. We move into 1 Kings 1 and it talks about now David is old and advanced in age. So, I ask the question, who is Abishag the Shulamite? Shunammite, excuse me.
She became David's nurse.
She became his nurse. All right. She was, what was she specifically, what was one of the things that specifically said she was doing?
She was brought
in to lay with him and to keep him warm. He's of old and advanced in age. She was essentially there as a human heater. I think that women can understand that with their husbands, a human heater. But she was brought in to attend to the king and become his nurse, and let her lie in your bosom that my lord the king may keep warm. There was nothing other than that involved there. That becomes important later on. So, who is Adonijah? All right, David's son.
His fourth son is Paul Bratt.
Tell us how you really feel. His fourth son, that's actually a question I was going to ask outside of the questions that I have here. It was David's fourth son, and I completely agree, it's Bull Bratt. So, again, the research that you do, you can go down the rabbit hole of this sort of stuff. But so, David had a lot of sons. So David's first son was Amnon by Anoahim, the Jezreelite. Then there was a son named Daniel, also named something else, by Abigail. Son number three was Absalom. Son number four was Adonijah. Son number five was Shephtah. And son number six was Ithream. They were all born in Hebron. All right, now, what happened to Amnon? He was killed. What happened to Absalom? Killed. What happened to Daniel? We don't know. We don't know. But Adonijah's essentially the fourth son of David. All right. In monarchies, who eventually takes over the throne? Oldest living son. All right. So we know that Adonijah's gone. I mean, we know that Amnon's gone. We know that Absalom's gone. We don't know what happened to Daniel, though. It may indicate that maybe that this son by Abigail maybe not isn't around or had passed away too. And so here you've got Adonijah, son of David, fourth in line to the throne, is now maybe first in line to the throne in a traditional sense that we're introduced here. Give a reason from the context, outside of the fact that he's the fourth son, as to why Adonijah thought he could take the throne.
His father never crossed him.
What is that supposed to mean? Never told him. Is that all that David never did? No discipline, no nothing. That worked out so well for Adonijah, correct? No. Spoiled brat. Again, we can take the detour for a second. What do us as fathers have a responsibility to do? Discipline and instruct our children. Ephesians 6:4. We can look at Ephesians 6:4 and understand that we have that responsibility. I joke, we have a responsibility to beat our kids. Now, obviously, in the group that we're in tonight, I can jokingly say that. I don't mean that. We should discipline them correctly. But we have a responsibility to teach them what's right. Spare the rod, spoil the child, right? If you disagree with me, who's the wisest man on earth? Was the wisest man on earth? Solomon. Go read some of those Proverbs he wrote. There's six or eight of them that you can kind of string together talking about discipline and how he felt about it, being the wisest man, the Proverbs that he wrote. We have a responsibility to teach, to instruct, and to discipline our kids so that they can grow up to know God, to know his love, and to do what's right. Didn't seem that this is what David did for Adonijah. He'd never crossed him. So, what did Adonijah do? He just unilaterally decided to take the throne. And, you know, so he did. You know, that's kind of essentially what happened. So, he conferred with Joab, the son of Zeruiah, Abiathar, the priest, and decided to become king. And so that's what he did. Now this goes back to First Chronicles 22:10. David rehashed with Solomon what he was to be. He was to be the one who is to reign on the throne forever. And then we see in that same context that is told to Israel that they're to help Solomon build the temple. Like I said, can it be inferred that they understood that Solomon was to be the next king? So is this a coup? Adonijah just chooses to do this and just goes behind everybody's back and decides to exalt himself? Thoughts, questions, opinions to that? Or do you think that this was just a misunderstanding? It was a coup? Anybody on the misunderstanding side of things?
No, I think it was a coup.
You think it was a coup?
Yeah, he knew what he was doing.
It seems to me that too. And I wouldn't have said that before studying this, but you go back and look, and it seems to me that it was spelled out pretty clear that, and we can see that in the verses, that it was understood that Solomon was to be the king. And Adonijah, nobody had ever raised a hand to him, nobody had ever disciplined him, decided, well, I'm just going to take it. Nobody tells me no. Nobody. This is the idea of being entitled. Just do what I want. And then when you get upset or you get, you know, offended when people don't do what you want them to do, you know, that's the way this appears. It appears that he tried to unilaterally take the throne. I agree.
Because he is plotting, and so he didn't invite Nathan. He didn't invite the mighty man, and he didn't, you know, Solomon. So he's behind the scenes doing it.
It is interesting, though, that Joab and Abathar went with him, and that's because they're two well-known figures, one being a priest and one being the commander of the army. But it is also telling to me, when you didn't have the prophets or the mighty men or who was over the Cherelites and the Pethelites, that being Ben Ahiah, or Zadok the other priest to go with them. So, just to conclude the talk about Adonijah, you know, we have an understanding, or we can look at this and understand that we have a responsibility to teach and to instruct and to discipline our kids. Otherwise, they'll turn out like this. At least that's a possibility. We can at least say that. I'm not going to say that. That happens to everybody. I mean, you talk to my wife and she said, oh no, she was a perfect kid. I don't believe that for a second. But no, we need to discipline and we need to instruct. And you know, your kids may tell you that they're perfect, but they're not. And they need the firm hand from mom and dad to teach them, to instruct them so they know what's right and wrong. We set those boundaries so that we don't raise a spoiled brat. We don't let them run our lives. We don't let them become entitled and then they don't care or are concerned about rules, laws, what's supposed to be done. We talked about who helped Adonijah. Who did not help? We've mentioned that for a second. Who wasn't invited to the celebration? Name those people again.
Nathan the prophet,
Zadok the priest,
Benaiah,
Shimei, which is not the other Shimei.
Yeah. Rhea, R-E-I.
We don't know who that is as far as I know. All right, mighty men or Solomon. So we've kind of got this divide now. These men weren't invited, and does it seem by design? Yes, it seems by design that these people were left out. As we move on, what does Bathsheba plead to David for? So it's brought to Bathsheba's attention that this is going on by Nathan, and so what does Bathsheba plead to David to do?
Proclaim Solomon king.
Verse 20, as for you now, my lord the king, the eyes of all Israel are on you, to tell them who shall sit on the throne of my lord the king after him. That's what she's pleading. You tell them. If it wasn't spelled out before, spell it out now.
And he had promised her.
He had promised her. He had. Thoughts on... thoughts on if David had stayed silent. Thoughts on what if David had stayed silent? Bathsheba and Solomon would have been killed. I'm getting a lot of quizzical looks. It wouldn't have been coming through the right son, or God would have found a different way. I you know, there's both of those. What I'm thinking about, though, and this is, like I said, you got to be in my mind, but in this, had David not spoken out, wouldn't you say silence is complicitness? Silence is a way to show support or show approval. So if David had not come out against Adonijah or exalted Solomon, Could you have taken his silence as support? I would say so. We've got to be careful about that as well. Staying silent when something is happening when we should speak out, and that's a very broad generalization where we can be more specific about different things, but silence can mean approval or support. And if David stays silent, it would have indicated, I believe, that he was supporting what Adonijah was doing. And, you know, so Bathsheba comes to him and asks him to speak out. What does Nathan ask in verse 24 and imply in verse 27? Okay.
If you did, why didn't you tell your servants? Or
yeah, so did you, you know, so verse 24, my lord the king, have you said Adonijah shall be king after me, and he shall sit on my throne? And then, has this thing been done by my lord the king, and you've not shown your servants who should sit on the throne of my lord the king after him? Kind of like, did you do this, or maybe you need to jog your memory, or... I was struggling for the word to describe that. Did you forget to tell us? Like, did you do this and did you forget to tell us? He's in his old age now. And I think it's a matter of just, hey, this is what was supposed to happen. This is going on. It's important that we, you know, fulfill what God had, the covenant God had made with you. You exalt Solomon to become king. Who does David name as king, and in what ways does he affirm his choice? Solomon is king. That's easy enough. But how does he affirm this choice? So Adonijah's got this party going on. He's exalted himself king. It said over in, let's see here. In verse 9, Adonijah sacrificed sheep and oxen and fatlings by the stone of Zohophlith, which is in Rogel, and invited all his brothers, the king's sons, and all the men of Judah to the king's servants. So this is what he sacrificed. So what does David do for Solomon to affirm his choice? Had Solomon ride on his donkey? What'd you say, Alex?
He had him anointed by Zadok the priest, Nathan the prophet. You read that verse 38.
Okay, so he had him anointed by Zadok and by Nathan, Nathan being the prophet. Had him sit on the throne, and then they proclaimed it to everyone. Whereas it doesn't necessarily seem that Adonijah was proclaiming it to the country. They proclaimed it for everyone to see. What better way to affirm who the king is to be than to let him ride on the king's donkey or the king's mule, to sit him on the throne, to be anointed by not only one of the priests, but by who everybody knows to be one of the prophets. That'd be equivalent to if you're going to become the new monarch of England, to be riding... you know, sitting on the throne or riding in the official vehicle or those sort of things. You know, it's not the person who's hiding out in the back room. He's the king. It's the person who is taking on that responsibility or taking on the possession or the position that we can see by, you know, official vehicle, a mule, or the people who are supposed to anoint him like they do when they anoint the new monarchs in England, that sort of stuff. So this is how he affirms it to the nation that Solomon is to be king. They blew the trumpet. Yes, ma'am.
Drawing attention. This is our king. This is your new king. Well, and it was in front of all the people. So it wasn't in some back room somewhere. It was for everybody to see.
Well, that's interesting, too. You know, it says here, verse 9, they sacrificed, but then it says, and he invited all his brothers and the king's sons and all the men of Judah. And, you know, have you ever sent invitations out the night before a party? How many responses you get? You notify everybody. Everybody kind of finds out after the fact. I can invite everybody. We're going to have everybody come to my house right after service is over. Who's going to make it? Who's going to be there? You know, that's not the way that works. You know, he just invited. That's the way Adonijah did it. Whereas this is proclaimed to the world. We're not hiding it. We're making it known. You're not getting something, an e-invite in your inbox that may go to your spam folder. This is proclaiming it to the country. Questions, comments as we kind of move through this section? All right. So Solomon's anointed king. Do the people approve of Solomon as king?
Yes.
Yes. Look at verse 40. All the people went up after him, and the people were playing on flutes and rejoicing with great joy, so that the earth shook at their noise. I think this presents a problem for some people. So, how did Adonijah and his posse react to the news that Solomon became king?
They were terrified.
And wouldn't you be? You just tried to, you know, at the least, you were very inept and unaware, and you just took the position of leadership in a country versus your brother who's been promised it. Or, at worst, you did this behind his back. You tried to usurp his authority and probably would have eventually tried to kill him. Wouldn't you be afraid when all of a sudden that didn't work out for you? Yeah.
I'm worried what Solomon's going to do to
him. Yes. Verse 49, then all the guests of Adonijah were terrified, and they arose and each went on his way. And Adonijah was afraid of Solomon, and he arose and he took hold of the horns of the altar. He was scared to death. Now it was told Solomon, behold, Adonijah is afraid of King Solomon. For behold, he has taken hold of the horns of the altar, saying, let King Solomon swear to me today that he will not put his servant to death with the sword. Solomon said, if he is a worthy man, not one of his hairs will fall to the ground. But if wickedness is found in him, he will die. All right, well, he made conditional. I'm not going to kill you unless you're not worthy. And so, it didn't look so good for Adonijah and them. I think that he's kind of getting that wake-up call that we see so many, or unfortunately maybe not so much anymore, but we see entitled people get from time to time. They need the wake-up call that not everybody's there for your beck and call. You don't just get everything that you take. There are consequences to your actions. All right. First question under instructions to the Levites and Solomon regarding the temple. Scratch that. We're going to talk about that later. That snuck in there without me knowing it. And we're going to talk about that in a different lesson. So the who did David gather together? That one we're going to skip for now. All right. So like I said, we're bouncing back and forth between Kings and Chronicles as we see this story develop with David preparing for the temple, Solomon becoming king. And then we're back into Chronicles again as we continue with Solomon becoming king. So in 1 Chronicles 23, and this is a larger section, 1 Chronicles 23 through chapter 29. Who does David gather together in chapter 28, verse 1? And what does he tell them in 28, 6 and 8? He gathers all Israel. It says all officials of Jerusalem, along with Solomon, and what does he tell them? All right, he's going to build a permanent home, but let's see, verse 6. Verse 6, it says, your son Solomon is the one who shall build my house and my courts, like what Alex was saying. For I have chosen him to be the son to me, and I will be a father to him. I will establish his kingdom forever if he is resolutely performs my commandments and my ordinances, as is done now. So now, in the sight of all Israel, the assembly of the Lord, and in the hearing of our God, observe and seek after all the commandments of the Lord your God, so that you may possess the good land and bequeath it to your sons after you forever. So, if there was any doubt before that Solomon was to be king, after you see it being affirmed through the different things that David did for him, and after Adonijah runs away scared, and after the people proclaim, you see here what David's saying. And he's talking about this covenant that God had made with them. What does he charge Solomon to do in verses 9 and 10 and also in verse 20? That end of verse 9, if you seek him, he will let you find him. But if you forsake him, he will reject you forever. What's verse 10 say?
The Lord's chosen to build a sanctuary.
And it says, and be courageous and act. Verse 20, then David said to his son Solomon, be strong and courageous and act. Do not fear nor dismay, for the Lord God, my God is with you. And he will not fail you nor forsake you until all the work of the service of the house of the Lord is finished. Be courageous and act. Do what you've been instructed, what you've been told to do. Build the temple. And follow his statutes, follow his ordinances. Same instructions as far as being a leader, not necessarily building the temple, but the same instructions that the other kings got. If you're willing, if you'll follow my statutes, if you'll follow my ordinances, if you'll follow my commandments, then you'll be blessed. And don't worry about building the temple. As long as you do these things, God will be with you. He will not fail you nor forsake you until the work of the service of his house, the Lord, is finished. That may mean that he's not going to allow anybody to attack him, to infiltrate him. I'm not exactly sure what that means. That may be that. But as long as you're doing, don't be strong and courageous and don't fear or dismay. What did David give Solomon in verses 11 through 18 in this context? The pattern on how to build a temple. Now, is this something that David dreamed up? God told him. So God has told them how to build this temple. Gave them the blueprints. They've got the materials. Now they've got the blueprints. These blueprints came from God. So now they're going to build this house of God. This house where God will reside, be in the nation. Chapter 29. Who pledged their allegiance to Solomon that day? All Israel. All the officials, the mighty men, the sons of King David. Everybody pledged their allegiance to Solomon. Back over in 2 Kings 2, who does David mention in verses 5 through 9? So let's flip back over to, if you're following along in the Bible. Back over in 1 Kings 2, 5 through 9. Who did David mention in verses 5 through 9 and what was to be their fates? Joab being one of them. So what did you say, Rocky?
The sons of Barzillai.
The sons of Barzillai, okay. And Shimei. All right. Solomon is to decide what they're, okay. What kind of indication do we get on those as to what may happen to them?
Not to be unpunished.
Now, who's that? Joab and Shimei. What about the sons of Barzillai? Now, we didn't really talk about Barzillai, but if you look, he's one of the men that that helped David as David crossed the Jordan and came back. And so David in his old age is trying to rectify some things. Joab has shed blood for him. He's also been kind of underhanded. He's done some things that he shouldn't have. What are some things that Joab is going to be held accountable for?
Killed Absalom?
He didn't kill Absalom. Yeah, he did kill Absalom. Who else, though?
Abner.
Who else did you say?
Amasa.
And so you've got him who's going to be held accountable for those things. What about Shimei? He's the one who cursed David. And so, but when he came down to me at Jordan, I swore to him by the Lord, saying, I will not put you to death with the sword. Now, therefore, do not let him go unpunished. For you are a wise man, and you will know what you ought to do with him, and you will bring his gray hair down to Sheol with blood. So it seems to me that there's death in the future of Joab and Shimei, and we'll see as we move on that that's the case. And then we see that kindness should be showed to the sons of Barzillai. And then we get to the end of a section for us, and we get to the end of a chapter in this section of the United Kingdom where David dies. David dies, and now Solomon reigns as king. Now we've got a couple of minutes left, and so I put down here. We're going to look at the man, the myth, and the legend, David. We've talked about him for so long. He takes up or encompasses a lot of this United Kingdom study. He was a man after God's own heart. So name some things. I got a list here, but name some of the highlights of David. I mean, if we're going to talk about David and the person that he is, let's name some of the things that are notable in his life. He slew Goliath.
He was a shepherd boy, and God was with him, and he talks about that in some of the Psalms. And he killed the lions and the bears, but he was faithful as a shepherd.
And I tie those together. So he slew Goliath, but it was the fact that he had the courage and the faith, to do what he did as a shepherd boy, and then he had the courage and the faith to stand up. This was a pivotal time in the nation. When the Philistines are knocking on their door and they're sitting there berating the Israelites and their God, and the king, Saul, wouldn't go out and face them, but here you got a shepherd boy. Anywhere from 13 to 20 goes out there, and he sits there and he rebukes Goliath before he takes his head, before he kills him. And then kill him with the sword, he kills him with the sling, and then goes and takes his head. Pivotal time. And, you know, you can see that there, that faith and courage is being exuded out of David. And, you know, that, you know, maybe begets the legend in a sense. Now we know who David is. Now we know there is one who is righteous and worthy of God. God had said he would find one and anoint one who was a man after his own heart. And it took a long time from the time that that was said until David came on the scene. What else? What else are some things about David?
Killed thousands of people.
He couldn't build the temple because of bloodshed. What did you say, Rocky?
I'm impressed with David on the number of times he inquires of the Lord seeking guidance. Over and over again, you see that. It's a remarkable trait of him.
He did. He constantly is inquiring after God as he continues to go through his reign as king. And we may have a lot of issues. He may have a lot of issues, but he does. He continues to inquire. Alex?
Showed a lot of mercy and restraint. He could have slain Saul, but he didn't.
Mm-hmm. You know, there's so much. I'm gonna run through these before Matt buzzes me out. But, you know, he was pleasing in the eyes of the people when he went out and came in. That has something to do with the mercy or the judgment that he showed as he kind of went in and out. He escaped Saul time and again, and he did show mercy. He showed love and respect for God. We talked about that. He kept his statutes, commands, his ordinances as his anointed. He showed great fierceness in battle. Todd talked about that. He brought together the mighty men who now are with Solomon, this great band of men who are fierce and fight. He made Jerusalem the capital city and the home of God where the temple would be built. He expanded the borders of the nation. You think about that. He finally cleared out all the other nations as Joshua should have done. He amassed a huge treasure to provide for the building of the temple. And he always put God first. He stayed humble. He sought after God and his will. And he catapulted this nation onto the world stage. And that's kind of what sets the stage for our next class. We're going to move into Solomon and how the nation get to where it is. David. And we'll talk about, is this the greatest time in Israel's history? And how was it the greatest time in Israel's history? But all right, that's it for this evening. Yes, ma'am.
Do you know how old David was when he died?
I didn't look it up. He's old. He's 70. I have it on good authority he was 70.